smiled at each other. They were feeling as happy to see Peacock going as he was to be going. The non-coms felt they had carried his load throughout Holland and the Ardennes. No one tried harder than Peacock, Christensen declared, but it was a job he was not cut out for. Peacock announced that Lieutenant Foley was taking command of the platoon. Then, with a cheery, "Good luck to you all," he was gone. As Peacock left, Father John Maloney brought Joe Toya back from the aid station in Bastogne in his jeep. He dropped Toya off by the road. Toya started walking across the field toward the front line. Winters saw him, his arm in a sling, heading back toward the front. "Where are you going?" Winters asked. "You don't have to go back to the line." "I want to go back with the fellas," Toya replied, and kept walking. That afternoon, January 3rd, Winters pulled 2nd and 3rd platoons, plus an attached bazooka team from the 10th Armored, out of the advanced position. He left 1st Platoon, temporarily attached to D Company, which, like most of the companies in the 101st, was down to 50% or less of authorized strength and needed help to maintain the MLR. 2nd and 3rd platoons began hiking back to their old positions in the section of the woods overlooking Foix. It was about 15:30. The lead units decided to take a shortcut across the open field to get to the foxholes before dark. The other units followed. The Germans saw them. When the men ducked into the woods, they noticed immediately that the Germans had zeroed artillery in on the position. There were shell holes and branches from tree bursts all around the foxholes. The shell holes were big, indicating heavy artillery, probably 170 millimeters. No one had to give an order. Every man went to work at once to strengthen the cover of his foxhole. Sergeant Lipton grabbed an axe and ran over to the nearest small trees, about 50 meters beyond his foxhole. He heard German guns open in the distance. There was not enough time to get back to his foxhole, so he jumped into a small open hole someone had started to dig and then abandoned. It was so shallow that even when lying flat in it, Lipton's head from his nose up was above ground. So he saw the first shells bursting in the trees. The sound was deafening and terrifying. The ground rocked and pitched as in an earthquake. The men from the bazooka team had no foxholes. Two of them were killed immediately, a number of others wounded. Sergeant Joe Toya was in the open, shouting orders to his men to take cover. "They always said, if you can hear the shells, you'll be okay," he recalled. "I did not hear the shell. It exploded just above him. Shrapnel all but tore off his right leg and hit him in the stomach, chest, and both arms. The shrapnel in his chest area was later removed by two separate operations, taking it out from the back. As suddenly as it began, the shelling stopped. It had been the worst shelling Easy had endured in the war. All through the woods, men were calling out for a medic. Lipton ran back to his foxhole to get his rifle, expecting an infantry attack. He heard someone moaning in the next foxhole. A tree, 16 inches in diameter, had fallen over it. Lipton tried to move the tree, but could not. Help arrived. The men dug around the tree, and Private Shep Howell came out, grinning. Toya yelled for help. He wanted someone to drag him into his foxhole. Sergeant Guarnieri got to him first and began dragging him over the ground. The shelling resumed. The Germans had planned well. As they anticipated, the pause had brought men out of the foxholes to help the wounded. A shell burst over Guarnieri's head. Shrapnel tore into his right leg, mangling it. After a few minutes, the shelling ceased. Lipton came out of his foxhole. Lieutenant Dyke called out to him. "I can still hear him with that deep voice of his," Lipton recalled. "He was about 25 yards away, without his helmet or a weapon." "Sergeant Lipton," he yelled to me, "you get things organized here, and I'll go for help." And with that, he left. Lipton began rounding up the men who had not been hit. Some of them were close to breaking. Some were amazingly calm. He sent some to tend to the wounded, others to organize to receive the infantry attack he was sure was coming. Then he went to check on Guarnieri and Toya. Lipton looked down at Guarnieri. Guarnieri looked up and said, "Lip, they got old Guarnieri this time." Malarkey joined them. Guarnieri and Toya, as he recalled, were conscious and calm, no screaming or yelling. Joe says, "Give me a cigarette, Malark." And I lit the cigarette for him. There was a pause in our interview. I urged him to go on. "I don't want to talk about it," Malarkey said. Another pause, and then he continued. Joe smoked, looked at me, and asked, "Jesus, Malark, what does a man have to do to get killed around here?" Stretcher Bearers got to Guarnieri first. As he was being carried away, he called out to Toya, "I told you I'd get back to the States before you." Lieutenant Buck Compton commanded 2nd Platoon. He was very close to his men, too close in the opinion of the officers. Compton was a close friend of mine, Malarkey said. He didn't like the status symbol in the Army. He was more friendly with enlisted men than he ever was with officers. He was especially close to Guarnieri and Toya. When he came out of his foxhole, Compton saw carnage all around him. The nearest wounded were his friends, Guarnieri and Toya, their legs dangling from their bodies, their blood turning the snow bright red all around them. Compton started running to the rear, shouting for medics or help of some kind. He finally calmed down at the aid station. It was found he had a severe case of trench foot. He was evacuated. Compton had won a Silver Star at Brécourt Manor on June 6, 1944. He had been wounded later in Normandy and again in Holland. He had stood up to everything the Germans had thrown at him from December 17th to January 3rd, but the sight of his platoon being decimated, of his two friends torn into pieces, unnerved him. Peacock gone, Dyke taking a walk, Compton gone, one replacement lieutenant who had turned himself in to the aid station with trench foot, which by this time almost every member of the company had, and another who was suspected of shooting himself in the hand. The battalion commander had to be concerned with the problem of the breaking point. Winters related his feelings in an interview. "I had reached that stage in Bastogne where I knew I was going to get it. Sooner or later, I'm going to get it. I just hope the hell it isn't too bad. But there never was a fear in me that I was going to break. I just felt that I was going to be hit sooner or later. But as far as the breaking point, no." After a reflective pause, he went on. "But you don't see people getting hit around you every day, every day, every day, continuing on, and not knowing how long this was going to go on. Is this going to go on forever? Am I ever going to see home again?" "For the officer," he continued, "with the additional burden of making decisions constantly under pressure, when there had been a deprivation of sleep and inadequate food, it was no wonder men broke. It was the policy of the U.S. Army to keep its rifle companies on the line for long periods, continuously in the case of the companies and infantry divisions, making up losses by individual replacement. This meant that replacements went into combat not with the men they had trained and shipped overseas with, but with strangers. It also meant the veteran could look forward to a release from the dangers threatening him only through death or serious wound. This created a situation of endlessness and hopelessness, as Winters indicated. Combat is a topsy-turvy world. Perfect strangers are going to great lengths to kill you. If they succeed, far from being punished for taking life, they will be rewarded, honored, celebrated. In combat, men stay underground in daylight and do their work in the night. Good health is a curse. Trench foot, pneumonia, severe uncontrollable diarrhea, a broken leg, are priceless gifts. There is a limit to how long a man can function effectively in this topsy-turvy world. For some, mental breakdown comes early. Army psychiatrists found that in Normandy, between 10% and 20% of the men in rifle companies suffered some form of mental disorder during the first week, and either fled or had to be taken out of the line. Many, of course, return to their units later. For others, visible breakdown never occurs, but nevertheless, effectiveness breaks down. The experiences of men in combat produces emotions stronger than civilians can know. Emotions of terror, panic, anger, sorrow, bewilderment, helplessness, uselessness, and each of these feelings drained energy and mental stability. "There is no such thing as getting used to combat," the Army psychiatrist stated. in an official report on combat exhaustion. Each moment of combat imposes a strain so great that men will break down in direct relation to the intensity and duration of their exposure. Psychiatric casualties are as inevitable as gunshot and shrapnel wounds in warfare. Most men were ineffective after 180 or even 140 days. The general consensus was that a man reached his peak of effectiveness in the first 90 days of combat, that after that his efficiency began to fall off, and that he became steadily less valuable thereafter until he was completely useless. By January 3, 1945, Easy Company had spent 23 days on the front line in Normandy, 78 in Holland, 15 in Belgium, a total of 116. Statistically, the whole company was in danger of breaking down at any time. There was no German infantry follow-up attack that night, nor in the morning. The medics cleared out the wounded. The bodies of the dead stayed out there, frozen, for several more days. Lieutenant Dyke reappeared. Things got back to normal. On January 5th, E Company was pulled back to regimental reserve south of Foix. There, two men, the acting battalion commander and the first sergeant of E Company, thought about the same problem, the officers of that company. As Winters put it, "I look at the junior officers and my company commanders, and I grind my teeth. Basically, we had weak lieutenants. I didn't have faith in them. What the hell can I do about this?" He knew that if he were lucky enough to get some additional officers, they would be replacements just over from the States, after completing a hurry-up training program. As to the company commander, Winters stated flatly, "Dyke was sent to us as a favorite protege of somebody from Division HQ, and our hands were tied." Winters saw no quick solution. In the meantime, he decided, in a pinch, talk to your sergeants. His first sergeant wanted to talk. Lipton asked for a private conversation. Winters said to meet him in the woods behind Battalion CP that night. They met, and Winters expressed his concern about the company commander. He described Dyke's actions, or lack of them, with damning detail. He ended by saying, "Lieutenant Dyke is going to get a lot of E Company men killed." Winters listened intently, asked a few questions, kept his own counsel. Replacements came in. "I could not believe it," John Martin confessed. "I could not believe that they were going to give us replacements and put us on the attack. I figured, Jesus, they'll take us out of here and give us some clothes or something. But no, they get you some replacements and, come on, boys, let's go." And then that's when we start attacking. He was right. The woods form a U around Foy, with the village smack in the middle. In the attack of January 3rd, the Americans had taken control of the right-hand portion of the U. Next would come an attack on the left-hand portion. On January 9th, the company participated in the clearing operation in the woods west of Foy. Resistance was light. The company reached its objective and dug in. Suddenly a shell burst in the trees, then another and another. They kept coming. Corporal George Lutz was caught out in the open. He began racing toward his foxhole. Sergeant Muck and Private Alex Pencala called out to him to jump in with them, but he decided to get to his own. And with shell bursts all around, splinters and branches and whole trees coming down, made it and dived in. Lipton was sharing a foxhole with Sergeant Bob Mann, the company HQ radio man. The Germans sent over some mail. A shell that was a dud hit just outside their foxhole. Lipton looked at it. Mann lighted a cigarette. Lipton had never smoked, but he asked for one and that night had his first cigarette. Lutz went to check on Muck and Pancala, the men who had offered to share their foxhole with him. The hole had taken a direct hit. Lutz started digging frantically. He found some pieces of bodies and a part of a sleeping bag. The 101st now held all the woods that encircled Foy from the east, west, and south. But Foy, down in its little valley, was not the objective. Noville and the high ground was. General Taylor had wanted to carry on the January 9th attack right into Noville, but for that he needed tank support, and as the tanks could only operate on the road, he had to have Foy. The village had already changed hands 4 times. The 2nd Battalion of the 506th got selected to take Foy. It was pulled out of the line west of Foy and put back in south of the village. Winters picked Easy to lead the assault. It was a simple, brutal operation. Charge across an open, snow-covered field of some 200 meters in length down into the village, where every window could be a machine gun post, where every German had brick-and-mortar protection. That was all there was to it. No subtlety, no maneuvers. Just charge and get close enough to the enemy to use grenades to root them out of rooms. The key was to get across the field quickly. If the men pressed the attack, if the cover fire was heavy enough, it should be simple. If they paused, it could be costly. Division ordered the attack to kick off at 0900. Winters did not like the timing. He argued for a first light start to reduce exposure, but was turned down. Winters was watching as Easy formed up for the attack. Standing behind him was a platoon leader from Dog Company, 1st Lieutenant Ronald C. Spears. Spears was an officer with a reputation. Slim, fairly tall, dark hair, stern, ruggedly handsome, he cultivated the look of a leader and acted it. One of his fellow D Company junior officers, Lieutenant Tom Gibson, described him as a tough, aggressive, brave, and resourceful rifle platoon leader. His nicknames were Sparky, among his fellow officers, and Bloody, with the enlisted. He had led a bayonet attack and won the Silver Star in Normandy. There were stories. The rumor mill swirled around Lieutenant Spears. No one ever saw it happen with his own eyes, but he knew someone who did. They may be just stories, but they were believed or half-believed by the men of E Company. One story was about the time in Normandy when Spears had a major problem with drinking in his platoon. He put out a blanket order. No more wine. None. The next day, he ran into a drunken non-com. He gave an order. The non-com back-talked him, and he took out his pistol and shot the man between the eyes. The conclusion to the story goes like this, and he never had any trouble with drinking after that. Then there was the day in Normandy when Spears was walking down a road by himself and passed a group of 10 German POWs. They were under guard and were digging a roadside ditch. Spears stopped, broke out a pack of cigarettes, and gave one to each POW. They were so appreciative, he jumped into the ditch and gave them the whole pack. Then he took out his lighter and gave each one a light. He stepped back up on the road and watched them inhale and chat. Suddenly and without warning, he unslung the Thompson 45 caliber submachine gun he always carried and fired into the group. He continued raking back and forth until all the POWs were dead. The guard was stunned. Spears turned and walked away. Tom Gibson, who related this story to me, I heard it from many other sources, although no one saw it happen, commented, "I firmly believe that only a combat soldier has the right to judge another combat soldier. Only a rifle company combat soldier knows how hard it is to retain his sanity, to do his duty, and to survive with some semblance of honor. You have to learn to forgive others and yourself for some of the things that are done." Gibson said he had told the story often over the years, never naming names, but using it as an example of what can happen in war. He continued, "We all know war stories seem to have a life of their own. They have a way of growing, of being embellished. Whether the details are precise or not, there must be a kernel of truth for such a story to ever have been told the first time." Winters was not thinking about Spears and his reputation. He was watching Easy Company attack. Spears and other officers from the unengaged companies stood behind him. Winters had placed the 2 machine guns of HQ section to provide covering fire over the open fields sloping away in front of them, about 200 meters across from the tree line to the town line. There were some scattered trees and haystacks in the field. Standing on the spot in 1991, with Winters, Lipton, and Malarkey, when Winters indicated that he had set up 1 machine gun just there, pointing at my wife Moira's feet, she looked down, bent over, and picked up a .30 caliber shell casing to hand to him. The field had recently been plowed. Lieutenant Foley, who led 1st Platoon on the attack, described the situation. "We knew that Foy had not been tested the previous day or scouted last evening. In the days before, we were well aware of the coming and going of trucks and tanks. We were witness to the many attacks and counterattacks that had taken place. We had seen F Company get chopped up in their efforts to hold this spot. Now they were commanded by a second lieutenant, so the unknown was ahead. The company moved out, line abreast. The covering fire opened up. There were only a few random rifle shots from the village. Still, as Winters put it, it was tough going for the men through that snow in a skirmisher formation, but the line was keeping a good formation and moving at a good pace. 1st Platoon, on the left flank, came on an area with some cow pens and small outbuildings. Foley had the shacks checked out. As the men from the platoon, only 22 of them, went to work, three Germans were seen scrambling into a shack. Foley had it surrounded, kicked the door in, then said in his best German, "Come out with hands up." No reply. Foley pulled the pin on a fragmentation grenade and tossed it in. After the explosion, the Germans emerged, shaken and bleeding. One was a first lieutenant, the other two were sergeants. Foley started questioning them about the whereabouts of other German troops. One of the sergeants reached his hand into his open coat. Another made a similar move. The third cried out, "Dummkopf!" One of Foley's men cut the Germans down with a burst of his submachine gun. "We had no prisoners," Foley commented, "but we had the concealed pistols." The platoon hurried to rejoin the others. Dyke looked left and could not see his first platoon. His other two platoons were moving forward steadily. They were being fired on but had not taken any casualties. But Dyke was naked on his left, or so he thought. He made a disastrous decision, the kind of decision that gets men killed. He signaled for the 2nd and 3rd platoons to join Company HQ section behind two haystacks. From Winter's point of view, suddenly the line stopped about 75 yards from the edge of the village. Everyone hunkered down in the snow behind those stacks and stayed there for no apparent reason. I could not get any response from Lieutenant Dyke on the radio. The company was a bunch of sitting ducks out there in the snow. He worried about how long he could keep up the suppressing fire. 1st Platoon caught up with the company, grouped behind the haystacks. Foley came to Dyke for orders. Dyke didn't know what to do. Foley insisted he had to do something. Lipton and the other sergeants supported him strongly. Dyke came up with a plan. It consisted of sending 1st Platoon on a wide flanking movement to the left to circle the village and launch an attack from the far left. Meanwhile, he would direct machine gun and mortar fire from the haystacks. For that purpose, Dyke said, he was keeping the platoon's mortar and machine gun men with him to participate in the suppressing fire. So 18 riflemen of 1st Platoon went out into the snow to try to get into Foy from the far side. Lieutenant Foley and Sergeant Martin had only a few minutes to plan the route that would get them to an assault position. They picked a path that provided, every 10 meters or so, a tree to hide behind. The line of trees went on into the distance. One by one they took off. Within minutes, snipers began to fire. Cries for medic went up and down the line. The platoon returned the fire, but without noticeable effect. Foley went to the nearest wounded man. This was Smith from California. He moaned and groaned as I ripped open the aid kit, and before I found his wound, he began confessing. Imagine! And what he confessed was that he and two other buddies had come across a PX ration and taken it. This consisted of Hershey bars and cigarettes. I told him that he wasn't dying as I cut open his pants leg, sprinkled on the sulfa, and wrapped his leg. Martin told Private Frank Percante to move behind another tree and start shooting into the buildings from there. So Frank goes over and gets behind a tree a little bigger than his head, but it wasn't quite big enough for his ass. So they shot him in the ass. When Lipton saw Percante the next day, he was lying in the snow in a pool of blood, but was still conscious and strong. Lipton asked, "Percante, how bad are you hit?" He grinned and replied, Lip, a beautiful wound, a beautiful wound. Martin directed Private Harold Webb to a tree and told him where to fire. Foley got on the radio. We're held up by sniper fire. We can't spot the location. We've lost 5 men. Can you locate? Advise. Someone from Company CP called back to say that the first haystack to Foley's right could be the spot. Foley came back, rake that damn stack, even as his platoon began firing at it. Lieutenant Dyke, in Lippman's judgment, had fallen apart. He was frozen behind the haystacks. He had no plan. He didn't know what to do. To the watching Winters, that was obvious. Here he had everybody hunkered down in the snow and staying there for no apparent reason. Winters was frustrated by his inability to raise Dyke on the radio. Get going, he would call out. Keep going. No response. Easy Company was taking needless casualties. All it needed was the leadership push to get across the last open space and into town. But the leadership wasn't there. Winters grabbed an M1 and started to run across the field, headed for the stationary company in its pinned-down first platoon. He intended to take command, get those men moving. But as he ran, he thought, "Geez, I can't do this. I'm running this battalion. I can't commit myself." He turned and raced back. And as I was coming up, there was Spears standing right in front of me. "Spears, take over that company and relieve Dyke and take that attack on in." Spears took off running. Winters turned his attention to his job. Lieutenant Foley described the results. Winters commanded the machine gunners to lay down a base of protective fire so that we, 1st Platoon, could finish off what we had started, and for the mortars to concentrate on those 2 haystacks. A grenade launcher let go with several rounds, and when the stack began to burn, the 2 snipers became casualties. Regiment put 1st Company, 25 men strong, on the right into the attack. But success or failure rested with E Company. This was an ultimate test of the company. It had reached a low point. Neither the officers nor the men were, on the average, up to the standards of the company that had jumped into Normandy. None of the officers who led on D-Day were with the company in 1945. More than half the enlisted men were new. The core of the old company left was the NCOs. They were Tekoa men, and they had held the company together since Dyke took over in Holland. They lived in a state of high alert and sharp tension. They lived and soldiered and tried to suppress feelings, always there, feelings that John Keegan points out are the products of some of man's deepest fears, fear of wounds, fear of death, fear of putting into danger the lives of those for whose well-being one is responsible. They touched, too, upon some of man's most violent passions, hatred, rage, and the urge to kill. In this torrent of passion, uncontrollable thoughts raced through their minds. They had seen their officers take a walk, or break, or just cower, or go mute, as Lieutenant Dyke was at this moment of crisis. If they did not have the option of walking away, they did have the option of not leading. No one could force them to do so. Just as they could not force Dyke to act. These NCOs were Tekoa men, all that was left in Easy from the hot summer of 1942 and Captain Sobel. They had held the company together through a long stretch of inept command at the top and heavy losses among the enlisted ranks. So this was the test. Back in 42, the question was, can a citizen army be trained and prepared well enough to fight Germans in a protracted campaign in Northwest Europe? Hitler was not the only one who had answered no. But the answer that counted would come on the snow-filled fields of Belgium in January 1945. For Easy Company, the test was now being given. The sergeants had it ready to be tested. The Tekoa core of the company was ready to be led and to lead. At this moment, Spears arrived, breathless. He managed to blurt out to Dyke, "I'm taking over." Sergeant Lipton and the others filled him in. He barked out orders, 2nd platoon this way, 3rd platoon that way, get those mortars humping. All out with those machine guns, let's go. And he took off, not looking back, depending on the men to follow. They did. I remember the broad open fields outside Foy, Spears wrote in a 1991 letter, where any movement brought fire. A German 88 artillery piece was fired at me when I crossed the open area alone. That impressed me. Standing at the site in 1991 with Winters and Malarkey, Lipton remembered Spears' dash. He also recalled that when they got to the outbuildings of Foy, Spears wanted to know where I Company was. So he just kept on running right through the German line, came out the other side, conferred with the I Company CO, and ran back. Damn, that was impressive. As the platoons with Spears moved out, 1st Platoon started to move toward them. Sergeant Martin made a last-minute check. He noticed Private Webb in firing position behind a tree, not moving. "Come on, Webb, let's go. Get out, come on." No response. Well, hell, they were still shooting, so I made a dash over to the tree, which is just a little bigger than your hand. And I jumped right on top of him, because it's hard to lay down beside. I turned him around, and they'd shot him right between the eyes. The company surged into Foy. The men fired the full range of weapons available to a rifle company. M1s, Tommy guns, bazookas, light machine guns, mortars, and grenades. They had artillery support. They created a tremendous uproar, with bullets zinging off buildings, explosions in the rooms from American grenades, the thump of some mortars taking off, the boom when they hit, scattering bricks and dust through the air. Resistance was strong, even so. German snipers, bypassed in the first rush, began to inflict casualties. No one could locate one guy especially, who had stopped movement at a corner with two hits. Then Shifty Powers, the man who had spent so much of his youth spotting for squirrels in the upper tree trunks of the Virginia mountains, called out, "I see him," and fired. "We weren't pinned down anymore," Lipton remembered, "so we continued the attack." Everyone resumed firing and advancing. Strong as the opposition had been, the Germans, the 6th Company of the 10th Panzer Grenadier Regiment of the 9th Panzer Division, were only fighting a rearguard action to cover a withdrawal to Noville. Still, they fought tenaciously, skillfully, and without panic to keep the escape route open. But as Spears moved his men forward and threatened to cut the road behind the German position, 3 Tiger tanks lumbered off, all that was left of the Panzer Company. A platoon or so of infantry got out with them. Some 100 Germans, mostly wounded, surrendered. Easy Company had won the test of will. It had taken Foy. Lipton and Popeye Wynn looked at the place where the sniper had held them up, the one Powers shot at. They found the sniper with a bullet right in the middle of the forehead. "You know," Wynn commented, "it just doesn't pay to be shooting at Shifty when he's got a rifle." It was early afternoon. A movie camera team moved in to take film of the victory. Back on the ridge line at the edge of the woods, Winters noticed 2 photographers taking pictures of the stretcher bearers bringing in the wounded from 1st Platoon. When the detail reached about 25 yards from the woods, well out of danger, one photographer put down his camera and dashed out to grab hold of the soldier to help carry him. He grabbed him in such a way that he got as much blood on the sleeve and front of his nice, new, clean, heavily fleeced jacket as possible. Then this guy turned toward his buddy, who was still taking pictures, and put on a big act of being utterly exhausted as he struggled across those final few yards to the woods. At that point, he immediately dropped out. That evening, Colonel Sink called for a meeting at Regimental HQ for all the principal parties involved in the attack. Sink opened with a question for Winters. "What are you going to do about Company E?" "Relieve Lieutenant Dyke and put Lieutenant Spears in command," Winters replied. Sink agreed with the decision, and the meeting ended. Lieutenant Foley also agreed. He wrote, "We were glad to see Dyke leave, not only because he failed the 1st Platoon, but even back in the woods when the 2nd Platoon was hit with those tree bursts, it was evident that Foxhole Norman wasn't meant to be our CO." It quickly became clear that Spears was. Indeed, he had already demonstrated that in the rush on Foy. Chapter 13. Attack. Noville, January 14th through 17th, 1945. When word came down for this attack, it pissed me off, Winters remembered. I could not believe that after what we had gone through and done, after all the casualties we had suffered, they were putting us into an attack. It just had the flavor of an ego trip for General Taylor, a play to show Eisenhower that now that Taylor's back, his troops will get off their asses and go into the attack. That is not fair to General Taylor. The attack was part of a general offensive designed to cut through to the north and link up with the U.S. First Army, thereby trapping the German tanks in the tip of the salient. Or as many as were left after Monty's shilly-shallying about getting going on the counteroffensive. The Germans had begun to pull their tanks back. They could be expected to fight with all they had to keep that escape route open. As to putting a company as badly mauled as Easy into a frontal attack over a snowfield in bright daylight, this didn't come about because Taylor wanted glory, but because Eisenhower needed men. He had no reserves available to throw into an attack. This was the moment to attack. He had to attack with what was there on the front lines. In other words, Easy was paying the price for the policy of limited mobilization. There simply were not enough troops for the job. After Foy fell, Easy and the other companies in 2nd Battalion were put into regimental reserve south of the village. At 04:15 the following day, January 14th, the Germans launched a counterattack on Foy with 6 tanks and a company of infantry. It was repulsed, but then another attack with 14 tanks and a battalion forced the 3rd Battalion of the 506th out of Foy. Easy was alerted, but with the help of the artillery, the 3rd Battalion was able to mount its own successful counterattack, and by 09:30 was back in the village. These actions were carried out under horrid conditions. Another cold front had passed through the area. Daytime temperatures were about 20 degrees Fahrenheit. At night, the mercury plunged to below 0 Fahrenheit. There was almost daily snow. It was difficult for division to move supplies up the Bastogne-Foy road because of drifts and demands elsewhere. As a result, the men of Easy were almost as badly off as during the first week of the siege. There was not enough food. There were insufficient overshoes, blankets, and sleeping bags. Bed sheets were used for snowsuits. The terrain in front of Easy was also difficult. There was open ground to cross to get to Noville, dense wood still to be cleared. The Germans held the high ground, and the solid Belgian buildings in Noville offered sniper and machine gun positions while providing the Germans with hiding places for tanks. Colonel Sink told Winters that 2nd Battalion would have the honor of leading the attack on Noville. He would jump off at 1200 hours January 14th, moving from the woods south of Foy around to the left, west, occupy the tiny village of Recugne, then attack over an open, snow-covered field toward Cobru, another tiny village a kilometer or so east of Noville. On Winter's left, 1st Battalion would move north through the woods to clear them out. Winters was unhappy with the orders. He had 2 kilometers of snow-covered open fields to cross to get to Cobru. It was a bright, sunny day. Why attack at high noon? Winters would have preferred to wait through the night, then set out at first light to cross the field. But Eisenhower wanted action. Monty wanted action. Taylor wanted action. Sink wanted action. So 2nd Battalion's HQ, Dog, Easy, and Fox companies would have to provide it. There was a fairly deep shoulder running southwest out of Noville to near Recugne. Winters saw that by sending his men straight for it, he could pick up more and more cover as they got closer to Noville. He put the battalion in single file to cut through the snow, dangerous but quick. As Easy and the rest of 2nd Battalion moved out, so did the 1st Battalion on the left. German tanks in Noville got 1st Battalion in their sights and let loose with some 88s. They did not see 2nd Battalion marching toward Noville in the shelter of that shoulder. Winters glanced to his left. The 88s were tearing up the 1st Battalion. Men were flying through the air, Winters recalled. Years later, in the movie Dr. Zhivago, I saw troops crossing snow-covered fields being shot into by cannon from the edge of the woods and men flying through the air. Those scenes seemed very real to me. Easy was having its own problems. German machine guns in Neuville opened on the company at a draw and stream that slowed the Americans while they were exposed. Spears set up two of his machine guns to answer the fire. As the American machine gunners let loose with a burst, a group of 8 or 10 would dash across the small stream. The stream was narrow enough for most of the men to jump across, but Private Tony Garcia, carrying an ammo bag with 6 rounds of mortar ammunition, fell into the stream. He was soaked. By the time his group reached Neuville, my clothing had frozen, causing a crackling sound as I walked. This, however, saved me from going on an all-night patrol, which was to have made contact with one of our own units. The platoon sergeant said I could be heard all the way to Berlin, and for me to stay put. Garcia has another memory of that day. One of the more disturbing incidents that affected me was seeing a horse standing in the snow, helpless, with one of its front legs shattered by shell fragments. One of the non-coms mercifully put it out of its misery with a couple of bullets to the head. Though man's brutality to one another is tragic enough, to see helpless animals suffer by his actions is even more tragic. By 15:30, 2nd Battalion had crossed the field and was snuggled up to the underside of the shoulder. By dark, it had worked its way around to a draw on the southeast corner of Cobru. Spears held a meeting of the officers and First Sergeant Lipton. He outlined the plan of attack for the morning. Up the draw to Neuville, with 2nd Platoon on the left, 3rd on the right. Friendly tanks were supposed to be coming up on the right in support on the Foy-Neuville Road. After the meeting, Spears told Lipton to lead the 2nd Platoon in the attack. Lipton pulled 2nd Platoon together to brief the men. Winters stood to the side, listening. Lipton told them the distance to the town was about 800 meters, that they should move quickly to get down to the road and into the shelter of the buildings, that they should clear out the buildings, working together as teams with rifles and grenades, that the mortar men should be ready to drop rounds on German strong points, that the machine gunners should set up and lay down a base of fire and support, that they should not bunch up, and so on. Winter's sole comment was that the distance was more like 1,000 meters. As the meeting broke up, the men could hear tank motors starting up and tanks moving around. It was not possible to determine if it was Germans pulling out or Americans coming along the Foy-Neuville Road. Winters remembers the night as the coldest of his life. There was little shelter, only hastily dug foxholes. The men had worked up a sweat getting to Cobru. They shivered through the night. They would lie down and drift off, only to be awakened by intense shivering in their now frozen clothes. Most gave up on trying to sleep. It got so bad that at one point Winters thought about ordering a night attack, but decided against it because of the danger of shooting each other in the confusion. Lipton was uneasy about leading 2nd Platoon on an attack without knowing what was up ahead, so he decided to go forward with a radio man to scout the situation in Neuville. The two men came to a barn on the outskirts of the village, entered it by a door in the back, and felt their way through to a door that opened into a courtyard near the main road through Neuville. Everything was quiet. Lipton called Spears on the radio to tell the CO where he was and to request permission to scout the town. He said he could see some Sherman tanks up ahead and asked if Spears knew if American armor had already taken the town. Spears did not know and told Lipton to look around. Lipton moved silently forward to the tanks. They were knocked out. American bodies lay frozen and strewn around them. They had been left there when Team Des Aubries had withdrawn from Neuville on December 20th, almost a month earlier. The Germans still held the town. Lipton and his radio man withdrew. The attack jumped off at dawn, January 15th. There was resistance, strongest on the right-hand side of the road against 3rd Platoon. The 2nd Platoon quickly got into the center of Neuville and up to the burned-out Shermans. The 3rd Platoon got into a burned-out building and set up a CP. Over the radio came a message. Friendly armor on the right. As Lieutenant Shames and Sergeant Alley got that message, they heard tanks outside the building. Anxious to get the show on the road, Alley told Shames he was going to link up with those tanks. Shames decided to join him. They moved by several burned-out buildings and rounded a corner into the main road. Up ahead, between two buildings partway out, was the tank they sought. Allie moved up to the side of the tank. The tank commander was standing in the turret, looking the other way, so Allie shouted to him over the roar of the engine to come this way. The tank commander turned, and Allie realized he had mistaken a German tank for an American. The German swore, dropped into his tank, and began traversing his turret toward Allie and Shames. They said not a word to each other. They took off so fast they were kicking snow in the German's face. The tank followed. The Americans ran around a corner. Shames saw an open window and dived in head first. Allie ran 3 meters or so past him and jumped into a doorway with his rifle ready for the infantry he was sure would be with a German tank. The tank turned the corner and drove right past Shames and Allie. It came to the place where 2nd Platoon was clearing out buildings near the burned-out Shermans. Lipton and his men dived under the Shermans or ducked behind walls for protection. The German tank stopped and, swiveling its turret, put a shell into each of the knocked-out Shermans to prevent anyone from using their guns to put a shell into his tank as he drove past. Lipton recalled, when those shells hit the Shermans, it felt to us, under them, that they jumped a foot in the air. The tank roared out of town, headed north toward safety. A P-47 fighter plane spotted it, strafed it, and dropped a bomb on it, destroying the tank. Allie went to look for Shames. He heard moaning and cries for help. When he got to the window Shames had dived through, he looked and burst into laughter. He saw his lieutenant tangled up in bedsteads, springs, and furniture in a basement Shames had not realized was there. By noon, 2nd Battalion held Noville and had set up a perimeter defense. The little village and its surrounding hills had been an objective of the 101st since December 20th. Finally, it was in American hands. We had looked northward at Noville from our positions outside Foix since shortly after we had arrived at Bastogne, Lipton wrote, and we had convinced ourselves that it would be the final objective in the Bastogne campaign. But there was one more attack to make. General Taylor wanted 2nd Battalion to move further north, in the direction of Oufalize, to clear the village of Rochon. Rochon was off the highway, over to the right, east. It was in a valley. The snow-covered ground sloped gently down to it from all sides, giving an effect similar to attacking from the rim of a saucer toward its center. The 2nd Battalion attacked from the south and southwest, while 1st Battalion on the left came down from the north of the village. The men were well spread and advanced steadily. The Germans put up some resistance, mainly artillery using white phosphorus shells. But as the men of the 506th got to the outskirts of the village, most of the German defenders fled. As the Americans moved in, the Germans began bombarding the village. Sergeant Earl Hale was one of the first into Rochon. He and Liebgott ducked into a barn, where they surprised and made prisoner 6 SS officers. Hale lined them up nose to nose and told them that if he and Liebgott got killed, they were going to take the Germans with them. Hale covered them with his Tommy gun to make the point. A shell exploded outside. Hale was standing by the door. He got hit by a piece of shrapnel and went down. An SS officer pulled his knife from his boot and slashed Hale's throat. He failed to cut an artery or sever the windpipe, but did cut the esophagus. Blood gushed out. Liebgott shot the officer who did the cutting, then the others. Medic Rowe got sulfur powder on Hale's wound. A jeep evacuated him to Luxembourg, where an amazed doctor patched him up, leaving a crooked esophagus. Because of Hale's condition, the doctor gave him a medical order stating that he did not have to wear a necktie. Later, Hale was stopped by an irate General Patton, who chewed him out for not wearing his necktie. Hale triumphantly produced his slip of paper, leaving Patton, for once, speechless. The easy victory at Rochon showed how completely the 101st Airborne had won its head-to-head battles with a dozen crack German armored and infantry divisions. The Americans had gone through a much more miserable month than the Germans, who had an open and bountiful supply line. For the 101st, surrounded, there were no supplies in the first week and insufficient supplies thereafter. Those were the weeks that tried the souls of men who were inadequately fed, clothed, and armed. This was war at its harshest, horrible to experience. The 101st, hungry, cold, underarmed, fought the finest units Nazi Germany could produce at this stage of the war. Those Wehrmacht and SS troops were well-fed, warm, and fully armed, and they heavily outnumbered the 101st. It was a test of arms, will, and national systems, matching the best the Nazis had against the best the Americans had, with all the advantages on the German side. The 101st not only endured, it prevailed. It is an epic tale as much for what it revealed as what happened. The defeat of the Germans in their biggest offensive in the West in World War II, and the turning of that defeat into a major opportunity to kill Germans west of the Rhine, as Eisenhower put it, was a superb feat of arms. The Americans established a moral superiority over the Germans. It was based not on equipment or quantity of arms, but on teamwork, coordination, leadership, and mutual trust in a line that ran straight from Ike's HQ right on down to E Company. The Germans had little in the way of such qualities. The moral superiority was based on better training methods, better selection methods for command positions, ultimately on a more open army reflecting a more open society. Democracy proved better able to produce young men who could be made into superb soldiers than Nazi Germany. What veterans of far-flung campaigns these German soldiers were was revealed in a little incident in Rachon. Sergeant Rader related it. "I almost killed a Kraut prisoner for laughing at me after I got to the town, only to have someone grab my M1 and shout, 'Sarge, he has no lips or eyelids.' He had lost them on the Russian front, frozen off." The battle made the 101st into a legend. The legend that began in Normandy and grew in Holland reached its climax in Bastogne. The 101st Airborne was the most famous and admired of all the 89 divisions in the United States Army put into the Second World War. Ever since, men have worn that screaming eagle on their left shoulders with the greatest of pride. In Rachon, Spears set up a company CP in a convent. It was the first time the CP had been in a building since Easy left Mourmelon a month earlier. That night, the nuns brought into the large hall of the convent a group of 12 and 13-year-old girls to sing a serenade for E Company. The program included French and Belgian songs, several in English, and the German marching song, Lili Marleen. The next morning, January 17th, the 17th Airborne Division relieved the 101st on the line. Easy Company got into trucks to begin a move to Alsace. The trucks took the men back down the highway they had sat astride for 4 weeks through Bastogne. It was only the second time most of the men had seen Bastogne. First on December 19th, when they marched through the town while frightened American soldiers fled to escape the German onslaught. Second, on January 17th, the town secured. Although the men had seen little of Bastogne, that name and the experience it represented would stay with them forever. Whenever thereafter a man from Easy experienced cold or hunger or sleep deprivation, he would remind himself of Bastogne and recall that he had been through much worse. Easy's losses were heavy. Exact figures are impossible to come by. In the hurry-up movement out of Mourmelon, the company roster was not completed. Replacements came in as individuals or in small groups and were not properly accounted for on the roster. Wounded men dropped out of the line only to come back a few days later. An estimate is that Easy went into Belgium with 121 officers and men, received about 24 replacements, and came out with 63. The Easy men killed in action in Belgium were Sergeant Warren Muck, Corporal Francis Mellett, and Privates A.P. Heron, Kenneth Webb, Harold Webb, Carl Sawaski, John Schindel, Don Hubler, Harold Hayes, Alex Pencala, and John Julian. The best description of the cost of the Battle of the Bulge to Easy Company comes from Private Webster, who rejoined the company during the truck ride to Alsace. He had been wounded in early October. Now it was mid-January. He wrote, "When I saw what remained of the first platoon, I could have cried. 11 men were left out of 40. 9 of them were old soldiers who had jumped in either Holland or Normandy or both. McCreary, Liebgott, Marsh, Cobb, Wiseman, Lyall, Martin, Rader, and Schulte. Although the other two platoons were more heavily stocked than the first, they were so under strength that, added to the first, they wouldn't have made a normal platoon, much less a company. Beyond the wounded and killed, every man in Bastogne suffered. Men unhit by shrapnel or bullets were nevertheless casualties. There were no unwounded men at Bastogne. As Winters put it, I'm not sure that anybody who lived through that one hasn't carried with him in some hidden ways the scars. Perhaps that is the factor that helps keep easy men bonded so unusually close together. They knew each other at a level only those who have fought together in a variety of tactical situations can achieve. As only those who endured together the extreme suffering of combined cold, not enough food, and little sleep, while living in constant tension, could attain. They knew fear together. Not only the fear of death or wound, but the fear that all this was for nothing. Glenn Gray wrote, "The deepest fear of my war years, one still with me, is that these happenings had no real purpose. How often I wrote in my war journals that unless that day had some positive significance for my future life, it could not possibly be worth the pain it cost." They got through the bulge because they had become a band of brothers. The company had held together at that critical moment in the snow outside Foy because First Sergeant Lipton and his fellow NCOs, nearly all Toccoa men, provided leadership, continuity, and cohesiveness. Despite a new CO and new officers and enlisted recruits, the spirit of E Company was alive, thanks to the sergeants. Having Winters as 2nd Battalion XO, and usually as acting battalion CO, Lieutenant Colonel Strayer spent most of the month at Regimental HQ working on an acting basis for Colonel Sink as S3, was a great help. And Spears was proving to be an excellent company commander, able to draw out of the company its best. That spirit was well described by Webster. By this time, Webster had been wounded twice and returned to combat after each occasion. He would not allow his parents to use their influence to get him out of the front lines. He would not accept any position of responsibility within E Company. He was a Harvard intellectual who had made his decision on what his point of view of World War II would be and stuck to it. He was a man of books and libraries, a reader and a writer, sensitive, level-headed, keenly observant, thoughtful, well-educated. Here he was thrown in the most intimate contact, pressed together on an open truck on icy roads in hilly country, sleeping in a foxhole with other enlisted men, with ill-educated hillbillies, southern farmers, coal miners, lumbermen, fishermen, and so on, among most of the enlisted men in the company. Of those who had been to college, most were business or education majors. In short, Webster was thrown in with a group of men with whom he had nothing in common. He would not have particularly liked or disliked them in civilian life. He just would not have known them. Yet it was among this unlikely group of men that Webster found his closest friendships and enjoyed most thoroughly the sense of identification with others. His description of his truck ride with his platoon to Alsace deserves to be quoted at length. "We squished through the mud to our trucks and climbed in. McCreary and Marsh lit cigarettes. Martin made a wisecrack about a passing officer. I asked what had happened to Hubler. Killed at Bastogne. Poor Hubler, who got such a kick out of war, dead in the snow. And the others? Muck and his buddy Pencala, who had the deepest hole in one position, had been killed by a direct hit. Sawasco was shot through the head attacking Foy, and so on. Some replacements who had come in after Holland had also died. A lot of men had been evacuated for trench foot. Too many, McCreary thought. The platoon wasn't what it used to be. Webster thought that it was. He had followed a long and complicated route through the replacement depots to rejoin